Okay, I think we're ready to kick off this session. Our speaker today is Tom Schuler, Director of Watershed Research and Practice with the Center for Watershed Protection. In celebration of American Wetlands Month, Tom will explore key ways of integrating wetland protection into local watershed management efforts. His focus will be on wetlands located in rural, suburban, and urban settings, and how they are directly and indirectly impacted by land development. Tom will describe how watershed protection tools can be adapted to strengthen wetland protection, conservation, and restoration efforts. We have an exciting presentation today, so let's get started. I'll now turn the microphone over to Tom Schuler. Good afternoon, Tom.
Thank you very much, Ron. It's a real pleasure to be on the webcast today. The title of today's talk is How to Integrate Wetlands into Watershed Protection Efforts. And there'll be a number of different ideas and management strategies that we'll describe. But first, if you go to slide number 2, for those of you who don't know about the Center for Watershed Protection, we're a not-for-profit group located in Ellicott City, Maryland, and we provide tools for communities to help them protect their streams, lakes, wetlands, and rivers, and work with a wide group of clients, watershed groups, local governments, and the like. And we have two websites, which are shown on the screen, and they're definitely available. There's a lot of good technical information on there about stormwater and wetlands and watersheds. And again, if moving to the next slide, number 3, May is a special month because it's America's Wetlands Month. There's a website that is shown on the screen that indicates the many events in your neighborhood or community to celebrate the great value of wetlands in the country. And this year's theme is it pays to save wetlands. Let me say that properly. It pays to pave wetlands. No, just kidding. Moving right along. We want to protect watersheds for a lot of reasons. In many cases, like the Pacific Northwest, we're there to protect fisheries. In other parts of the Midwest, the protection of forests and farms and the rural landscape is very important. Other areas, groundwater quality or drinking water quality, are the major drivers for watershed planning. In some cases, streams and lakes, their quality, as you can see in slide number 5, are the driving forces. But in recent years, there's been a trend to incorporate the conservation of wetlands into local watershed plans. And that will be the theme of my talk today. Going to slide number 6, the basic outline for the talk is a brief description of wetlands and the watershed functions they provide. And then a little bit more extended discussion on the direct and indirect impacts of land development on wetlands. And then I'll go through the case for local wetland protection using what we call the 8-tool approach. And we'll conclude with some resources. Moving to slide number 7, it goes over the 8 tools of watershed protection. And some of you who attended the webcast last May on 8 tools of watershed protection may remember them. But basically, it's a local approach to protect water quality using a combination of watershed planning, land conservation, aquatic buffers on streams, wetlands, and shorelines, better site design on the development that does occur, good erosion and sediment control on construction sites, effective stormwater management, control of non-stormwater discharges like septic systems, and illicit discharges. And finally, watershed stewardship, because watershed protection is fundamentally driven by the care and concern of the public for their watershed. So stewardship is a real key element. And to be effective in watershed protection, one can't just use 1 or 2 tools at one time. Communities have to apply all 8 very effectively if we're going to maintain our water quality. Moving to slide 8, let's spend a few minutes on the watershed benefits of wetlands. Nationally, wetlands comprise just a little bit less than 6% of the total area of the continental United States. Although obviously the distribution of wetlands in any given watershed varies greatly, from as little as less than 1% to almost 100%. Wetlands perform many important functions, and the degree to which they do those functions and services depends on their size and their position in the watershed. Important benefits include flood storage, pollutant removal, groundwater recharge, provision of habitat for aquatic and terrestrial life, and the protection of streams and shorelines from bank erosion. Moving on to slide number 9, many of you who know about the center may be familiar with the impervious cover model, which basically says that you can predict stream or lake quality based on how much impervious cover has been created in the watershed. It appears that the percentage of wetland cover is a fairly important variable in achieving those watershed functions shown in slide number 9. For example, according to the data of Mitch and Gosselink, water quality, phosphorus retention, and nitrogen removal begin to be fairly significant when wetland cover exceeds those thresholds. The same is true for the flood control function. So it's an interesting area of research. Much more research needs to be done, but hopefully in the next generation we can be able to predict watershed function based on the percentage of wetland cover, just as we do impervious cover. Moving on to slide number 10, when wetlands are lost or are degraded, those wetland functions of pollutant removal, flood attenuation, groundwater recharge, and the like need to be replaced, usually with fairly expensive engineering solutions that have high capital costs and ongoing maintenance. So as you see, if we lose a great deal of the wetland function in a watershed, it requires greater public investment in water treatment plants, stormwater practices, and agricultural best management practices to remove those pollutants. Similarly, if the flood attenuation benefits of wetlands are lost, a new engineered system of detention ponds, dikes and levees, and floodplain management is necessary to compensate and protect life and property. And so this, again, kind of reinforces the theme of America's Wetland Month, which is it pays to save wetlands. And I could go on with shoreline protection and wildlife, but most of you are probably very familiar with the great value that wetlands have in the aggregate in providing these functions. And that's often one of the great debates. In aggregate, wetlands provide those functions at a watershed level. An individual wetland, a small one or degraded one, may not provide them to that degree. So again, the key point is it's the aggregate watershed acreage of wetlands that creates those very important functions. Moving to slide 11, it's time to spend a few minutes defining some of the terms that we'll be using throughout this presentation. And I forgot to mention at the outset, I have a few caveats and confessions to make. One is I have traditionally treated wetlands and watersheds in separate silos, and it's only been in the last few years when I've personally began to understand the linkage between them. The second confession is I'm not a professional wetland scientist, and wetlands are very complex, both legally, scientifically, and from a regulatory standpoint. So it's very hard to generalize about wetlands. So bear with me in a few areas. And lastly, my last confession is I double parked earlier this morning to get to this place in time. So, having put that aside, let's talk about some of the basic concepts. And I'll run through five of them real quick. The first is the wetland inventory, which is the information available to local governments to make more informed decisions on the management of wetlands. I'd like to briefly talk about the landscape position or the hydrogeomorphic model. A very key point is contributing drainage area, and I'd like to also define, as we do at the center, wetland function and sensitivity, which are very important in the whole concept of protecting urban wetlands. Moving to slide 12, I think one of the most important things local governments need to do is to take stock of their wetlands, their size, their type, and their function. There is available mapping out there, but communities should just be a little bit careful. The most common mapping, which is the National Wetland Inventory, or NWI, which is shown on slide 12, was largely created in the 80s, and it tends to miss the smaller wetlands, typically less than 3 acres, and it may not be available for all states. And so probably the best choice is to use NWI, but also look for hydric soils and other indicator layers to try to figure out, at least at the desktop, what resources, what wetland resources you possess. Okay, moving to slide 13, the landscape position is a key concept. And to be honest, there's probably 2 or 3 dozen different wetland classification techniques out there. The one wetland classification technique that we prefer at the center is the HGM. And the reason for that is the HGM is most congruent, if you will, with watershed planning. Basically, under the HGM wetland classification, wetlands are classified based on where in the watershed they reside. So there's some wetlands that are in depressions, some that are on the slopes of hills, some that are on riverine areas, fringe wetlands along estuaries and lakes, flat wetlands such as bogs and fens, and then wetlands associated with headwater stream channels. And the key point about the HGM classification, which was first advanced by Brinson, is that it helps you determine the contributing drainage area and the potential wetland sensitivity of land development within that area. So it's, I think, a pretty important concept. Slide 13 shows some schematics that describe how these wetlands are classified. But moving on to slide 14, assuming that we have a wetland defined, which is that little blue sliver by the red dot on slide 14, the key point is what is the contributing drainage area? And this is the area that delivers surface runoff and groundwater to the wetland, although the actual monitoring of groundwater movement can be very complex. So this method is primarily a surface runoff approach. Okay, moving to slide 15, basically the key point here is depending on the HGM classification, each of those categories has a slightly different technique for how the contributing drainage area would be defined, whether it's a depressional wetland or a headwater stream channel wetland or the other four, which aren't shown on this slide. Which brings me to an important point. At this point, local governments are trying to define the areas that influence the wetland. They often don't go out and do the traditional three-factor plant, soils, wetland jurisdictional test, because that's really the permit applicant's responsibility. Here they're trying to find the approximate boundaries of the wetland and its contributing drainage area. All right, moving on to slide 16. This is one of my favorite wetlands. It's in Powhatan Creek. It's got a heron colony in the background if you have really good eyes. It's in the floodplain. It stores a great deal of flood water, removes a lot of pollutants, and is home to a lot of wildlife and rare and sensitive plants. The key point is that not every wetland is the same. They differ greatly in the functions and services that they provide. So if we contrast this wetland in slide 16 with the one in slide 17, we can see a great deal of missing functions as well as a few missing shopping carts in the foregoing scene. There are numerous field methods available to assess wetland function and stressors. At last count, more than 200. Some are very regional. Some are located for specific functions. But we'll talk about some options for that in just a few minutes. The key point about the slide number 17 is that urban wetlands typically look like the one you see in front of you. They have a lot of degradation due to the direct and indirect impacts, which we'll describe in just a second. All right, the last concept is wetland sensitivity. And wetland sensitivity gets to the point that different wetland types have different sensitivities to the indirect impacts of urban stormwater runoff and other influences. So this slide shows two panels, wetlands that are considered normally quite sensitive. These are wetlands like bogs and fens, the Atlantic white cedar swamp shown in the photo in the bottom, vernal pools, coniferous swamps, sedge meadows, and the like. On the right-hand side of slide 18 are the wetlands that aren't so sensitive. Phragmites marshes, reed canary grass, purple loosestrife, cattail marshes. We see those, they're often indicative of receiving a lot of stress. And also some of the wetland types like floodplain forests and fringe wetlands are not quite as sensitive as other hydrogeomorphic types, just because they're influenced more by tidal or riverine action than by on-site stormwater runoff. So with that, I think it's time for a Q&A break.
Great. Thanks, Tom. As Tom indicated, we're now on slide 19, which is our first question and answer break. A reminder to those participating online, if you would like to submit a question, please press the question mark button on your screen and you would be prompted for your question. Also, since Tom has already opened the door perhaps on wetlands favorites, maybe when you submit your question, you can tell us about your favorite wetland, where it is and what it's named. We do have no questions submitted online at this point, so I will now open the phone lines and see if there are any questions out there. If you could get our attention, and we'll say, ask who you are and where you're from, and then you'll be acknowledged. Okay, the phone lines are open. Any questions out there?
We have one in Region 10.
We have a question from EPA Region 10. Go ahead.
Tom, this is Devin Reed from Region 10, and the group here wanted to know what HGM stood for, that you referred to in the first part of your presentation.
Yeah, forgive me for not, it's the hydrogeomorphic method, which is a wetland classification system developed by Mark Brinson, which looks at or classifies wetland based on their position in the landscape rather than their plant community or so forth. So it's a pretty, it was developed on the East Coast, but I know, for example, that research on HGM classification has occurred in the Pacific Northwest as well. So it's now widely adopted, although it's adapted in different regions slightly.
Thanks, Tom. Any other questions from outside?
I have a question. This is from the state of Montana.
Yes, Montana. What's your favorite wetland?
Well, the question I've got actually is about the proposed mitigation rule that's been published in the Federal Register. And one of the ideas exposed in that is that we can replace wetlands through mitigation, wetland functions at different locations. So within a watershed, you could replace the water treatment functions of a wetland, flood storage or water cleaning, maybe in a more urban area, and replace the habitat functions in a more wild setting. And I just wanted to get Tom's perspective on that.
Okay, thank you for your question. I'll turn it over to Tom and then see if some folks here at EPA also have some comments.
Yeah, thanks for that softball question. I figured mitigation would come in pretty quick. We'll talk a bit more later in the webcast about some specific ways to deal with making sure that you're maintaining wetland function across a watershed. But I think if we have a few people from EPA that have some comments, I think.
This is Ann Campbell from the EPA Wetlands Regulatory Program. We thank you for your question on the mitigation rule that's currently out for public notice and comment, and encourage you to submit your comments and considerations through the comment period. In response to your question regarding replacement of wetland functions, sounds like off-site replacement of wetland functions, the Corps and EPA, through their regulatory responsibilities under Section 404, will use best professional judgment and scientific information to determine whether the wetland function that would be lost can be replaced off-site or whether it would be best to replace those functions lost closer to the actual impact site. That has been long since the policy and approach that the Corps and EPA have utilized, and I believe that the rule language would still support that type of analysis.
Thank you. Any other questions from on the phone lines? Okay, with that, I will now mute the phone lines. One or two questions submitted online. We do have a question from April in Vermont, and Tom, April asks, why are floodplain forests not considered quote-unquote sensitive? And sensitive to what?
Thank you. Well, the main reason that floodplain forests are not sensitive to extra stormwater inputs is that they are adapted to some degree of regular inundation and flooding throughout the year. And so I guess the point is if you have a 20-acre subdivision that's discharging to a floodplain forest, it would generally have less impact because there's probably a much larger watershed draining to that point. But the key point is what we recommend at the center is that each community come up with its own list of what it considers sensitive wetland types and non-sensitive wetland types, and in that process engage the local wetland scientific community, the naturalist community, and others to come up with the best list, because the list that we provided is one based on a literature review and some scientific investigation, but it will vary regionally in different parts of the country, and so it's an important decision for people to make.
Great. Thanks, Tom. We will now move on and continue with our presentation, starting with slide 20. Again, we will have additional question and answer periods. We do encourage you to submit your questions online, and you will be given an opportunity over the phone. And you might have a better chance of getting your question answered if you tell me what your favorite wetland is. Back to Tom.
Great. Well, moving on, let's talk about the potential impacts of land development on wetlands. And historically, the direct impacts are so well known to this group that I almost hesitate to go over them, but they're the dredging, the filling, the draining, and the dumping that occur during the land development process. Moving on to slide 21 is the shot from the Buzzards Bay National Estuary Program of a forested wetland shown in the green, outlined in green. You can see over time that a portion of the forested wetland was filled to build a subdivision. And we'll see in a few moments, we'll go over some statistics that basically indicates that the historical, or the leading cause of wetland loss in the country today is urban land development. The slide is also kind of useful, too, that not many of you may be aware, but there was recently a trends and status report that EPA and the the Fish and Wildlife Service put out. And they're beginning to see that wetland loss tends to be less than 5 acres, often less than an acre. But it's still a death by a thousand cuts when you have a lot of different wetland losses. An example of some of those wetland losses are the wetland fills for road crossings shown in slide number 22 and other activities that are allowed under general permit that often don't get a lot of attention. So wetland impacts and direct wetland impacts continue. The slide 23 shows historically what was the greatest source of wetland loss, and that was agricultural ditching and draining and filling. And while wetland loss still occurs in the agricultural sector to some degree, the most recent trends and status report shows that significant gains in agricultural wetland acreage as a result of Swamp Buster and the Food Security Act and the various wetland restoration programs contained therein. So that's some good news, I think, for wetland months, that in that area, at least, while wetland loss still continues in some areas, there is a great deal of wetland restoration that's taking place. But the story is urban wetland loss continues in urban watersheds. Slide 24 indicates some of the reasons why. To begin with, some of the smaller and isolated wetlands are not fully protected under state and federal statute. Mitigation, as one of our questions a few minutes ago asked, often occurs out of the watershed. So we often have urban wetland loss with mitigation occurring in more rural areas. And the mitigation doesn't always replace the same wetland type. And it's not always successful. It's been documented and chronicled in innumerable reports, the National Academy of Science report probably being the most comprehensive. Moving to slide 25, the pressures on wetlands are particularly great in our coastal areas. This is a shot of a watershed in South Carolina between 1994 and 1999, and you can see a pretty extensive wetland area and the very extensive development that occurred in a very short period of time. So one of the real challenges for local government is growth and sprawl are happening all the time. They have to come up with a good, effective wetland protection strategy as a stopgap to protect these wetlands. Slide 26 chronicles national wetland loss from 1950 to 2004. This is just updated for this webcast. This is data, again, done mostly by Dahl and his colleagues. And if you look in the middle, from the 50s to the 70s, most of the wetland loss, which was very great at the time, almost 500,000 acres per year, the loss from land development was only 8%. And even through the 70s, it was still less than 10%. But in the most two recent reporting periods from 1986 to 1997, and the most recent from 1998 to 2004, land development is now responsible for the majority of wetland loss in the country. Now, what's also interesting is I left the box blank under net annual rate of loss in the most recent reporting period. If you look at all wetland types, there was actually a slight gain in wetlands, again due to some of the agricultural restoration. But the biggest winner in wetlands in the last six-year periods were freshwater ponds. It's a very interesting cross-connection for my stormwater colleagues out there. We don't get credit for all the wetlands that we've been creating in terms of stormwater ponds and wetlands, but the number of acres is staggering. 700,000 acres in the last 6 years, or almost 125,000 acres per year. So these freshwater ponds, which are often designed for stormwater treatment, golf courses, or ornamental purposes, generally don't have many of the same functions as their natural counterparts. So I think the good news is that wetland loss is being reduced. The bad news is we're not sure whether wetland functions are being maintained, and I think that's a key element of the rest of the talk. Okay, if we move to slide 27, we were recently completed a really extensive literature review on the indirect impacts of land development on wetlands. This means the activities and operations that occur outside of the wetlands boundary that influence the quality and function of the wetlands. And it was a really fascinating literature search for a lot of reasons. One is the sheer number of different disciplines involved. There were articles in the herpetology journals, hydrology journals, conservation biology, stormwater management, botany, wetland science, wildlife management, landscape ecology, and the like. And it's a very scattered literature. But despite the fact it's done by a dozen different disciplines who don't use the same methods and define land development in many different ways, over 100 articles have been published, and most of them just in the last 5 years, from 30 U.S. states and Canadian provinces. We hope to finish and publish this literature review in just a month or two. We're in the process of editing it and getting external review. But I'd like to go over some of the key findings so far in a fairly brief period of time. The indirect impacts of stormwater on wetlands have five basic stressors. We alter wetland hydroperiods. We increase the nutrient loading to the wetland. We increase sediment deposition. We create conditions that favor invasive plant species. And in northern parts of the country, we have very high levels of salt that get into wetlands. Now, this is actually an interesting story in its own right. My first interest in the subject of the impacts of stormwater on wetlands was when, back in the early 90s, we were working on design guidance to create artificial wetlands to treat stormwater. And with the hubris of youth, we thought we created these wetlands and planted them with these fine native species, they would flourish and look like the wetlands we see on Sierra Club calendars and the like. Well, over the last 10 or 15 years, as we've looked at the product, they've actually been a nice little laboratory in their own that show that we don't always get what we want and that there are some major stressors, hydrology being one of them. Moving to slide 29, this is a graph that shows the runoff coefficient as a function of the percent impervious cover. The runoff coefficient merely expresses for a given volume of rainfall how much is converted into surface runoff. So if we have, as you see in the chart, 5% watershed impervious cover, we have less than 10% of that rainstorm producing stormwater runoff. But if we have a parking lot that's 100% impervious, nearly all of the rainfall is converted into surface runoff. This data, by the way, is from the Nationwide Urban Runoff Management Program, And it basically has like 40 different sites from around the country. It's a pretty tight relationship, but from a wetland management standpoint, what it means is that if we have a lot of development in the contributing drainage area, that we're going to get a profound change in the wetlands water budget, and that we're going to shift from a groundwater-dominated system to a surface water-dominated system. And what this means for the wetland is that instead of the water budget being one of the factors that define what the wetland is, it now becomes the hydrologic stressor. Let's move on to slide number 30. It shows how extra stormwater runoff can be a hydrologic stressor in urban wetlands. There's four basic impacts that appear from the literature. The first is to increase the depth at which water ponds in the wetlands. Secondly, it can increase the fluctuation of water levels, so there's a bigger bounce after every storm. Water goes up and down. A third impact is called hydrologic drought, which I'll define in just a minute. And lastly, we can have reduced groundwater input. So I'm going to ask you all to do a big trick here. Let's go back to slide 29. You can see how if we have a lot of development in the contributing drainage area, and we're converting rainfall into runoff, we have much less groundwater recharge to sustain the wetland. Okay? People get that? Great. So let's go over each of these hydrologic stressors in turn. Slide 31 shows probably the most common impact that we see. It's the one you see every time you drive down the highway and go to a road crossing or culvert. And it's what I call the woodpecker effect, the artificial woodpecker effect, where because of increased ponding from upstream development and the constriction at the culvert, we get greater water depths. In this case, we have a forested wetland that's being killed by the higher water levels. Okay, let's move to slide 32 and talk about the concept of hydrologic drought. This is one that affects streamside and floodplain wetlands the most. The basic notion here is urban streams experience a response to upstream watershed development. That response is channel incision, which means the grade of the channel cuts further and further down. As the channel cuts down, as you can see in the slide here, probably 8 or 10 feet, the water table drops with it. And so trees and plants and forbs that were in the floodplain are no longer in the floodplain anymore, that they don't have wet feet. And so there hasn't been a great deal of good systematic research on this. Probably the best work has been by Grace Brush in the Patapsco, or the Gwynns Falls, floodplains, but it's a pretty significant impact, at least anecdotally. Again, we've talked about road crossings and other constrictions, and they also affect the hydrology of streams and wetlands, as shown in slide 33. Okay, let's move to slide 34. Let's accept the notion that our wetland is getting a lot more runoff from upland development, and every storm event, the water levels go higher and then go back down. And so the basic idea here is water level fluctuation, known as WLF, which I first thought was a wrestling term. But at any rate, water level fluctuation is something that you can measure in a wetland. And some really pioneering work in the Pacific Northwest by a whole series of researchers have shown that when this bounce occurs and becomes greater, it is directly associated with reduced wetland plant richness, that is, fewer species of wetlands. In particular, thin-stemmed species, like sedges, tend to drop out quicker, and it promotes invasive species, and it also reduces amphibian diversity. So hydroperiod is a very significant change in wetland conditions, because most wetlands don't have a lot of surface water. Most wetlands are dry on the surface much or all of the year, and wetland plants, and in particular rare and sensitive ones, are adapted to a fairly narrow range of moisture tolerances. So if we basically treat our wetlands like a stormwater pond with very sharply changing water level fluctuations, we'll see generally a reduction in diversity, and that's what most studies have shown. The next slide on slide 35 indicates some data by Cook and Azus from 1997. It shows water level fluctuation on one axis for the various periods of time in the plant's life cycle. And you can see in this case that reed canary grass loves it when water levels fluctuate. And that's one of the areas of research that's still coming out, but it appears that water level fluctuation promotes certain invasive plants like reed canary grass, cattail, and Phragmites, and that less sensitive plants can't tolerate those widely fluctuating conditions. Moving on to slide 36, let's look at the water quality stressors. In general, there's about five defined stressors out there. One is simply the accumulation or deposition of sediment from upland areas into the wetland itself. That sediment can come from stormwater runoff, it can come from erosion from construction sites, and it can come from upstream bank erosion if the wetland has an inlet. And there's been a fair amount of research to indicate wetland degradation as sediment levels rise. The second area, sediment contamination, looks at the level of metals and petroleum and other pollutants in wetland sediments. And urban wetlands generally have a distinct signature, which is a high level of zinc, copper, lead, cadmium in some cases, high levels of oil and grease, and so there is a fair amount of research indicating that, A, they're removing pollutants, but those pollutants at some point are having an impact on the biological system. We'll talk a lot about nutrients in just a few slides, but I don't want to leave out our friends, the chlorides. Chlorides come in northern areas primarily from the application of road salt to keep our streets clear in the winter, and concentrations as high as 1,500 to 3,000 milligrams per liter have been found in going into wetlands. Those levels, according to over 30 different studies, have a direct impact on many different wetland plant species and as well as macroinvertebrates. So chloride is really an important pollutant to manage from the standpoint of wetlands. Let's just talk about nutrients for a few minutes. This slide is taken from the centers in the University of Alabama's National Stormwater Quality Database. And it shows the level of total phosphorus and nitrate present in residential runoff, commercial runoff, and open space. But I kind of fooled everybody out there because I didn't put the average concentrations to natural wetlands. And just for comparison, for total phosphorus, the concentration is 0.05 milligrams per liter, roughly 6 times lower than the stormwater concentrations shown. And for nitrate, it's about 0.3 milligrams per liter. So wetlands that receive stormwater runoff, almost by definition, will have higher levels of nutrients. Going to slide 38, let's combine two things together. If we have more runoff and we have more pollutant concentration and we multiply those together, the total nutrient load increases. So the chart shows, in terms of nitrogen and phosphorus, the load in pounds per acre per year. If the contributing drainage area is forest, turf, or impervious cover, and you can see pretty dramatic increases in the loading rates as the contributing drainage area is developed. Moving to slide 39, this is one of my favorite wetlands, but it's showing evidence of very high nutrient inputs as well, in this case from stormwater, agricultural runoff, and land application of chicken waste. But nutrient inputs to wetlands, when they get very high, they can degrade wetland function. So I guess the point is, while wetlands are thought to have great benefit as pollutant removal, like anything else, like a septic system or a sewage treatment plant, if we overload them with nutrients, the system will fail and degrade. So it's an important management concept to keep in mind. Moving to slide 40, what is the biological response to these stressors, the increased hydrology, the increased level of pollutants? Well, 50% of the studies out there were able to link changes in hydroperiod and water level fluctuation to reduced plant species richness, the loss of sensitive plant species, an increased number of invasive plants, and tree mortality. And I just put on this slide, on number 40 here, it's important to note that forests and wetlands often co-occur. And in fact, 60% of our freshwater wetlands are forested. So tree mortality is a significant indirect impact in the contributing drainage area. And we talked a little bit earlier in this talk about some wetland communities are extremely sensitive. Those, the research has shown, are things like fens and bogs and Atlantic white cedar swamps. Moving to slide 41, the remaining studies looked at the animal community, not the plant community. And again, there's a very consistent link that these hydrologic and water quality stressors change the plant community, and which in turn leads to declines in the species richness for macroinvertebrates, amphibians. And this is, since it's Wetlands Month, it's spring peeper. I suggest everybody go out to a wetland and listen to the chorus of spring peepers. Urban wetlands, you generally hear the chorus of ambulance sirens and so forth, but it's one of my favorite times of year. Reptiles and birds. And the studies are very consistent that the more development and the greater hydrologic and water quality stress, we see a sharp reduction for each of those types of animals. Now, upland development isn't the only cause. Literature shows things like proximity to roads and culverts and other disturbance play a role. For example, if there's a road close to a wetland, the loss of amphibians and reptiles by being run over by your expensive sports utility vehicle increases fairly dramatically. And the same is true with birds, that if we lose the buffer around wetlands and we have more cats, feral cats, and so forth. So it's not, you know, there's still a lot more to be teased out from the research. All right. Staying on slide 41 for a minute, I just wanted to spend a few minutes on some of the research needs. The research is really intriguing, and it really shows, I think, a good relationship between land development and the decline of wetland quality. But we need more systematic research. In particular, more studies that look at watershed quality as a function of wetland percent cover, I think it's time to have a national research meeting to get all these diverse disciplines together to share information and hopefully standardize methods to define things like contributing drainage area, to define how we measure land development, to look at groundwater and stressors that promote invasive species. Anyway, that's just my quick plug for some of the research needs. I think a lot more good urban wetland research is needed out there to help reinforce these links. Okay. In a practical sense, most communities have to make a really quick diagnosis and call about their wetlands. And they typically do those with some form of wetland assessment. As I indicated on slide 42, over 200 different techniques are currently available to assess wetland functions and values. Different types of wetlands perform different functions. These functions are often different in various places of the country. But I'd like to talk about one wetland assessment method that the center has been working a lot with, shown on slide 43. This is really a out-of-wetland experience method, I guess is the best way to say for. In our view, we don't know much about what's inside the wetland. We'll admit that. But what we want to know is how is the contributing drainage area influencing it. So we came up with the Y method. WI is half of Wi-Fi, I guess. But it's part of the unified stream assessment. And the teams go out and look for evidence of altered hydrology, water quality problems, altered vegetation, and the things you see on slide 43. The difference is we look at that stuff within the wetland, but we also go to any wetland inlet and outlet and move upstream or downstream as we see fit to identify some of the specific impacts and inputs out there. We also, as we'll see the next slide, number 44, it shows our little wetland in blue, but you can see there's two rings outside where we circumnavigate the wetland looking for ditches, storm drain pipes, impacts, and the condition within the buffer. And if we find an inlet or an outlet shown in the three dots, we go back up or downstream to try to identify the specific impacts that occur. And on slide 45, you see it's a pretty quick effort. We try to do it in a half an hour or less. It involves field sketches, digital cameras, a good working knowledge of wetlands, but also of hydrology and stormwater engineering. And one of the articles on our website shows how we use this method. So I think I will turn it over to Ryan. Slide 46 for a question and answer session. This is a sad picture on slide 46. Not a very pretty sight. We just saw this in our field work in South Carolina a couple months ago where you can see ditching of a forested wetland. So hopefully Ron will have more upbeat things to say.
Let me tell you a story, Tom. Now, we will now move to our second question and answer break. As Tom mentioned, we're on slide 46. I do continue to encourage you to submit your questions, and we have received several online. And Tom, just so you know, Matt in Indiana didn't have a question, but he wants to let you know that his Pigeon River Fen is his favorite wetland. Okay. Moving on to the question submitted online, Tom William from Texas wants to know, well, actually he says, society currently values the development of landscapes above the conservation of wetlands or sensitive ecosystems. How do you suggest that we reconcile this difference of societal values and societal willingness to accept wetlands loss?
Oh, another rather philosophical question, but a very important one. I think we constantly need to redouble our efforts at wetland education to describe in economic but also economic terms the benefits they provide, but also the values that they have. We often, in the wetland and watershed community, take it for granted that people love these things as much as we do. So education is a very, very important element to it. And I think in the watershed planning process, which many communities go through, it's really important to elevate wetlands up there with forests and other activities. And that historically has not been the case. I would say less than 5% of watershed plans that we've seen at the center have a really good wetland component. So there's a big job ahead of us, but I think the point that the gentleman makes is very good.
Thanks, Tom. And earlier you showed a photo of a wetland, one of your favorites, in Delaware. And we have an email from Delaware. Deborah wants to know, how can we determine the amount of nutrients a given wetland can take up before it becomes degraded? Is there any literature on this that you can refer to?
Excellent question. Short answer, not much. I think it's depending on different wetland types. Obviously, bogs and fens and others, there's a pretty good literature, as well as Atlantic white cedar swamps. For that bald cypress swamp I showed you, I cannot give you, as much as I would like to, a good scientific reference.
Work to be done. We have another question from Reggie in Indiana, and I'm looking around Webcast Central here and looking for someone who's willing to answer this. It may be Tom, it may be somebody else. But Reggie wants to know, do delineators actually assess the functions for regulatory purposes? I'll turn it over to Ann.
Traditional delineation manuals will cover the three parameters for wetlands, that is, plants, hydrology, and soils. However, the permitting process, the 404 regulatory permitting process, will consider the impact assessment and the functional assessment of the wetlands that are potentially impacted by a proposed applicant's project.
Okay, thanks, Ann. At this time, I will now unmute the phones and see if there are any questions out there. If you have a question, please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Teresa Beisel from Chicago.
Sorry, speaker from Chicago, could you speak up a little bit?
Yes. This is Teresa Beisel from Chicago. Can you hear me now?
That sounds great. Thank you.
In communicating to the general public, you made a point with slides 28 and 29 that increased development, increased runoff, equals less water for in the water table. Is there any clear way of communicating that you have seen to a general public?
The question relates to messaging to the general public on some of these notes that Tom is getting across.
It's a good question, and I think the answer to it is that those materials are easy to develop, and what works in most communities is to go out and do some systematic assessment of local wetlands and streams with a digital camera and be able to contrast them to local elected officials, watershed groups, and others, because people, I think, learn visually rather than through a lot of text, and the great advantage of the digital camera is that, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words, and most people may not understand the science, but they can understand the impact when they see it. So when they see that, you know, kind of disgusting urban wetland with the shopping carts in it, they know that that's not a healthy system. So it's a kind of an approach to contrast good wetlands against bad wetlands. And I think that's a very important educational tool.
Thank you.
This is EPA Region 8.
I'm sorry, hold on, EPA Region 8. We have another person in the room here who would like to add to what Tom just said.
Hello, this is Rebecca Dills. And just a suggestion in terms of education and outreach on the numerous technical points that Tom has raised is that in the resource section there are quite a few suggestions of websites to go to, and one in particular related to expressing wetland functions and values in a way that the general public can understand is the Isaac Walton League of America. They do an excellent job of translating technical issues into digestible tidbits for the general public. So I would just make that one suggestion to and point you to that area in the resource section.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. One more question, and EPA Region 8 had spoken up, so go ahead, Region 8.
Yeah, this is Gene Reed. First, I'd really like to commend your effort to document the indirect impacts. I think that's something that is often not recognized, so I would really encourage you to get the word out as much as possible to the different entities about the significance of that. I think the other aspect is that I think a lot of people look to Section 404 as kind of the end all to protect wetland resources, and a lot of these indirect impacts would not be covered by 404, and therefore other tools are necessary to address those indirect impacts. But I think that's, again, a very key area, and I'm really pleased to see you've done that literature search, and again, encourage folks to get the word out on that, because that really is very critical. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your kind thoughts, and I think the rest of the presentation will go over where 404 ends and local responsibility begins. And moving to slide 47, the current 404 wetland permitting program really isn't enough for the point the gentleman just stated. The wetland hydrology is not protected. 404 begins at the jurisdictional boundary of the wetland, and generally speaking, many wetlands are in the low points of sites that receive stormwater discharges, so the potential for indirect impacts are there. Although there are some states and localities who look at the quality and sensitivity of wetlands, it's generally not considered in stormwater permitting. And as I started out the talk, I think we've historically looked at stormwater management, which is the biggest influence in the contributing drainage area, and wetland permitting as two different silos, two different processes that are independent, two different permits to obtain from two different people who never agree. So it's important, I think, to address local government ability to protect wetlands. Because as the last point on slide number 47 is that we generally don't address cumulative impacts at the small watershed level. And I think it should be a clear goal in every community in America that in their watersheds they're not only achieving no net loss of wetland acreage, that they're maintaining the function, maintaining and enhancing the functions those wetlands provide, and possibly providing wetland gains. Now, slide 48 outlines some of the benefits of a local watershed approach to wetland management. And I think this is an area where state and federal regulators really need to be creative, innovative, and flexible. Because what's in it for the local governments to go above and beyond and protect their wetlands, either by protecting wetlands that are not covered or by regulating development in the contributing drainage area? Clearly, local land use and local development ordinances are needed to manage the indirect impacts that we just talked about. It can protect the highest quality and most vulnerable wetlands. I think one of the key benefits for local governments is that they have a market for restoration and mitigation sites within the watershed. They often have a lot of mitigation requirements themselves, whether it's the Department of Public Works or the Road Department or what have you. It will hopefully inform better permit decisions. Although I would caution folks that there's always a tension between local governments and the state and federal regulatory agencies. It's the fundamental difference between land use planning and development regulation and permitting under Section 404. So it's an area where if we want local governments to take on a greater role and manage the areas where 404 doesn't extend, we have to work in close partnership to make sure that happens. Because permits, you know, allow something bad to happen, I suppose. Whereas if you see in the last bullet of 48, we want to identify opportunities for voluntary wetland conservation and restoration, not only to prevent the bad things from happening, but to promote good things to happen at the wetland level. All right. Well, you remember the 8 tools of watershed protection, and I apologize for those people that see these little footballs in their sleep at night. But let's go through them real quickly and say, okay, if a local community wants to make a difference, they want to protect their local wetlands, how do they go about it? And this is enshrined in an article on our wetlands website, so I'll go through it fairly briefly. The first tool is land use planning. And this is, of course, a local government authority, and there's two ways local governments can do it. Three ways, I guess, on slide 49. The first is to incorporate wetland management elements directly in their local watershed plans. The second is to adopt a local wetland protection ordinance that outlines or is essentially an overlay zone within the contributing drainage area to the wetlands. The third is to modify other local ordinances, whether it be floodplains, stream buffers, forest conservation, stormwater, to, again, deal with that indirect impacts issue. And we'll talk about some of those opportunities in a few moments. But moving on to slide 50, what really is the outcome of a local watershed plan? And it's really not to sit there and deal with permits and individual problems. It's essentially to do four things, as shown in slide 50. The first is to assess the existing wetland quality and their sensitivity to future development. And this is very important because it outlines the needs for future protection as the watershed grows. The second key element is to assess existing wetland functions within the watershed. And this, the purpose of this is to look at all the wetlands in the inventory and determine which wetlands have the greatest function and therefore merit conservation. According to Tyner and other sources, less than 3% of all wetlands in the continental United States have conservation status by which they're in a conservation easement or otherwise protected in perpetuity. So our highest and best and greatest wetlands, this is the part of the watershed plan where we're trying to lock them up in some kind of conservation easement so the wetland, their buffer, and in some cases even their contributing drainage area might not be developed through a conservation easement. The third element of a good watershed, local watershed plan, is to investigate restoration potential in the existing wetlands that are impacted and former wetland sites, in particular prior converted wetlands. And the last area is to assess the creation potential at non-wetland sites. How can we get more wetland acreage in our stormwater ponds, in our wastewater treatment sites, and in our various forms of development? All right, moving right along. The center's put together a series of articles, and I'll breeze through these next couple of slides because I'm just a little bit off time here. But the basic watershed planning principles we would do for any watershed study are the same as what we do when we incorporate wetlands. So if you look at slide 51, we follow the same basic steps. We just look at different information. So, for example, we would compile wetland information on a watershed basis, put it in a watershed GIS. We'd assess local wetland protection capacity as it currently exists, invite wetland partners, define clear goals, screen wetlands, and so forth. Moving to slide 52, again, there's, you know, you most people would recognize this from any basic watershed planning textbook. It's just we've generally substituted wetlands for either watersheds or streams. A couple key points I want to outline in slide 53. If we make wetlands an important element of our watershed plan, we have a very important responsibility, and that's to make sure we invite our special wetland stakeholders to participate. And I'll be honest, these stakeholders are the toughest bunch of stakeholders I've ever dealt with in my career. But if they're not there in the beginning of the process, if they're not involved, it's not likely that many of the wetland elements will ultimately be implemented, because in many cases you need, if not the support or the blessing of this group, the state and federal regulatory staff that run 401 and 404 permits, local wetland scientists, the state and federal natural resource agencies. And the last group is really important. They're agencies with defined mitigation needs, typically highway departments, local or state, utility companies. And what they bring to the table is they have a need to do something right. So they often can be great implementers of the watershed plan. So the real tactical trick here is to turn stakeholders into partners and get this group of people to solidly support the wetland elements in the plan. At the same time, these wetland stakeholders have to realize that the watershed plan is not solely about wetlands preservation or conservation. But they can add a lot to the mix, as shown in slide 54. They're the ones that have the data on to support any acreage goals, whether it's regarding wetland protection, conservation, or restoration. They can analyze permitting activity to look at rates and causes of historic and current wetland loss. These are the folks that have the technical information that can tell us which wetlands are most sensitive to development in the watershed. And so I think it's very important to clue them in. And lastly, they're the ones that know the best wetland assessment protocols for the region or the state. So it's generally really good to incorporate them into the process, whether it be a subcommittee or informal meetings or what have you. But wetland stakeholders becoming wetland partners are real important. The last thing I'd like to mention is on slide 55, is the centers develop some tools by which local governments can audit themselves to see how good their watershed and wetland protection capabilities are. I believe it's available on our website. It's called the 8-Tool Audit, and it asks a series of questions, about 15 to 25 per each of the 8 tools, to identify specific weaknesses, gaps, and areas for improvement, and it helps communities identify how they can beef up their not only the protection of wetlands, but the protections of streams, forests, and other aquatic resources. So that 8-Tools audit is, I think, a really good tool. And finally, I'm going to move to 56. This is another of my favorite wetlands. This is the Pocomoke River. It's a blackwater wetland on the eastern shore of Maryland, and one of the nicest canoe trips you'll ever take. So I recommend anyone in Maryland to go there this weekend.
Great. Thanks, Tom. And as Tom indicated, we are now on slide 56, our third question and answer break, and the emails keep coming. We've received several emails. Again, we do apologize. I can guarantee you we're not going to be able to get to all of these, but we'll do the best we can. Tom, our first question comes from Mandy in Kansas, who wants to know, has there been a localized analysis in any jurisdictions to compare the loss of wetlands, dependent on baseline data, with increases in jurisdictional spending on stormwater or other engineered solutions to wetland loss?
Ron, can you paraphrase that question again?
Well, I'll see what I can do. Has there been any kind of analysis to compare the loss of wetlands with increases in spending on stormwater or other engineered solutions?
Great question. I can't think of any published information, but there's been a number of federal programs like BL-566 and other ditch and drainage programs that historically have lost wetlands. And in communities in the Mid-Atlantic and elsewhere, the conversion of natural wetlands into stormwater treatment facilities, and in other cases, the daylighting of stormwater pipes right to the edge of the wetland have, I think, been a major cause of that increase in freshwater pond acreage that we talked about earlier in the webcast. Some of those are bass ponds, some of those are farm ponds, but I would imagine, in my own experience, just every time I fly out of an airport, the size of stormwater ponds that are created, in some cases, in natural wetlands, are very impressive and somewhat sobering.
Thanks, Tom. We have an email from Stephen in Texas who wants to know, are there any national figures depicting the economic value of wetlands?
Good question. In the literature review, we've made an attempt to summarize some of the current economic research. It varies. There's our nationwide numbers, and there's local numbers for individual wetlands, and there's per acre cost. So the whole area of wetland economics is not my specialty, but there is several good reviews in the literature, which if you shoot me an email, I can at least give you those citations. I was going to ask if anyone else wanted to jump in on that question.
Hi, this is Donna Downing with EPA, and although, as he indicated, there are a variety of studies at the national level and some at the local, we often hear about from states about the value of the wetlands in their jurisdiction. And, for example, Indiana has stressed the importance of wetlands in protecting their multimillion-dollar salmonid fishery because it helps protect flood flows and water quality. And they say that last year, I guess in 2001, there were 874,000 recreational anglers who spent $519 million. We get similar data by states, but when people are talking about the value of wetlands, they tend to talk about a lot of components. The wetlands themselves, just knowing they're there in effect, and also the wetland functions that they serve beyond their own boundaries, such as improving water quality downstream or flood attenuation. And at times, the value to communities near the wetlands, that because they create open space and recreational opportunities. But there's a lot of data about this at the local level, and there are various books that are summarized in the literature of ways of analyzing it and so forth. But I think the many states have been very outspoken about some of the dollar value of the wetlands within their boundaries.
And just EPA headquarters, again, here mentioning that for basic general public information, you can go to our website, which is listed in the resource page, and there's an updated set of very general economic values of wetlands on that web page. There's a new fact sheet up there.
Great, thank you. We will take one quick question on the lines. Let me unmute. Anybody have any questions out there? That was easy.
Actually, if there's no question, I have a comment, and this is Phil North in EPA Region 10 in the Kenai River Center in Soldotna, Alaska.
Yes, Phil, quick comment.
Okay, it's just to really emphasize the importance of looking outside the wetland for wetland protection in the watershed. And as my quick anecdote, yesterday when we were working on the Homer Wetlands Plan and for Homer, Alaska, the community of Homer, Alaska, we kept running up against the limits of 404 versus the versatility of the city to have ordinances that would protect wetlands by protecting the uplands outside the wetlands. So it's really important. 404 is very limited. That's all.
Great. Thank you for that comment. I will now mute the phones. Slide number 57, and go back to Tom.
Great. Thank you very much. And just adding to that comment, we'll go home in the next 20 or 30 slides about what local governments can do to augment Section 404. The second tool of watershed protection and wetland protection is land conservation. And the steps here are pretty simple. Communities need to conduct a wetland inventory, create a good map by which they can define where wetlands are located and what their contributing drainage areas are. You do a little bit of field work and identify the priority wetlands that need to be conserved, and then select the land conservation techniques, and more commonly the partners like land trusts and others that will help lock up those areas, the highest and best wetlands. Moving to slide 58, I just wanted to emphasize the importance from a regulatory standpoint at the local level. If you want to regulate something in the subdivision process or in the development process, you have to have a map or a inventory that defines what's in and what's out. And so this is the equivalent, the local government's equivalent of the jurisdictional wetland, but it's a map and it's what's referred to in an ordinance. So if you want to have an ordinance, you have to have a wetland inventory in most cases. There are some exceptions for small communities, but the wetland inventory is really critical for local governments to consider if they want to expand local wetland protection, as shown in slide 58. The value of these are great. This is, in slide 59, is Yarmouth Creek watershed in Virginia, which is just outside of the first settlement of our country by Europeans, I guess, Jamestown. And our staff, Paul Serm and the rest, went through the many wetlands and so forth and came up with a series of priority conservation areas for what was a fairly lightly developed watershed. And it was very instrumental in getting the locality to make key choices. But again, for those people that are operating their wetland silos, it was not just about wetlands. It was about things like contiguous forests. It was about things like heron rookeries or maritime shell areas, things that get people excited. So, you know, wetlands by their very name are not particularly sexy in themselves. So these inventories need to have the important special places in the community. Moving to slide 60, a simple tool most communities should think about when it comes to protecting wetlands are to require a wetland buffer. Most communities in the country, at least the larger ones, do require stream buffers, but only, according to a survey by Ron O'Rell, of all people, a third of them have wetland buffers. Actually, that was the wrong citation. It's later on. But only a third of communities have wetland buffers. And the key issue is to, as shown in slide 61, is to try to integrate streams and wetlands together within the buffer program. So you see here, it's not just a fixed width going downstream, but the stream buffer expands to pick up adjacent wetlands so that we get a corridor and hub approach. And the other key issue is to, again, if we have a map, and most communities have excellent GIS capability these days, again, larger communities, the ability to express the buffer system spatially rather than as some fixed rule in an ordinance is a key element of many effective programs. Slide 62, we're going to have development in the contributing drainage area, at least in some wetlands. If we do, how do we make that development work to protect wetlands? Well, clearly the road layout needs to be carefully examined to minimize wetland crossings. The open space design, which clusters development on the non-wetland areas in order to protect forests and wetlands elsewhere, is a good tool. We want to encourage designs that use natural drainage and low impact development, or LID, which is explained a little bit more in slide 63. Basically, the approach is when we develop, we want to make sure we maximize the amount of recharge infiltration back into the ground. We want to minimize site impervious cover. All the rooftops, to the extent possible, disconnecting them so that they run onto grass areas or forest areas. Turf isn't the world's greatest surface, but it is a decent area for filtering. We also want to look at things like swales rather than curbs and gutters, conserving existing forest cover where possible, and reforesting turf areas. All of these tricks are important, but when they're aggressively used together, you can see a dramatic reduction in impervious cover, runoff, and pollutant loadings from developments maintaining the same housing density. So this is actually one of the areas where the National Association of Home Builders has partnered with the center to promote greater implementation of better site design on residential development projects. So in many cases, actually, the people who need their minds changed to permit better site design and low-impact development are the local governments that set the rules in the first place. Moving to slide 64, sediment matters to wetlands, and as I incorrectly stated earlier, Ron actually worked for the center many years ago, and he did a project and found that only 34% of local erosion and sediment control ordinances specifically regulated wetland or sediment discharges to wetland. So most local ordinances just deal with what leaves the property boundary or the site. If there's any wetlands within that project, they're not really considered explicitly in the erosion and sediment control ordinance. So here, too, is another opportunity for local governments to provide greater protection through existing regulatory programs. It might be simple things like putting performance criteria that say if you have wetlands present on your site, your erosion control plan shall clearly show perimeter controls at the buffer boundary, not at the edge of the wetland. It might say that if your development is in the contributing drainage area, more rapid vegetative stabilization is required, smaller disturbance thresholds. Maybe it's smaller than 1 acre of exposed soil if you have wetlands present in the CDA. And increased frequency of site inspections, so on and so forth. And I won't go through all the detail, but again, this is an opportunity where local governments have existing programs, ordinance, and staff. And with just some tweaking, they could make a real improvement in many wetland areas. Tool number 6 is the one I'll probably spend the most time on, and it's stormwater management. We've talked a lot so far about how stormwater runoff influences wetland quality. And here you can see one of the great divides at EPA, which is how to spell stormwater. In some areas, it's in this slide, two words. I think it's now one word. But anyway, there's two basic areas that we can provide better instructions to the design engineers that are doing stormwater management. That is, when they are working in or near a wetland, or if they're working in the contributing drainage area to the wetland. Moving to slide 66, let's talk about stormwater criteria when working in or near wetlands. And these are a great opportunity. Right now, under the NPDES Phase 2 stormwater permitting program, thousands of communities across the country must adopt stormwater management ordinances. And so there's an opportunity, perhaps now, to leverage some specific wetland protections in there. And so I put on this slide, on page 66, some of the perhaps performance criteria. to prohibit the use of natural wetlands for stormwater treatment. The Corps and EPA have been discouraging this practice for a long time, but it's still allowable. But you have the ability in your ordinance to say no, to discourage constrictions at wetland outlets, to not allow the discharge of untreated stormwater into wetlands, to avoid locating stormwater practices within wetland buffers, and to require that practices be fingerprinted around the wetlands. So they're just examples that might be used. You have to think carefully in each case, but it's a great opportunity if you're running a local stormwater program. Moving to slide 67, how can we change local stormwater criteria to protect wetlands better? Well, there's two basic ways we can do it. We can adopt special stormwater sizing criteria within the contributing drainage area that mandate a certain level of recharge, water quality, or hydro period maintenance. And we can also look at preferred stormwater practices. The idea is some practices protect wetlands better than others. So if I'm in a CDA, then it would say I have to use a smaller list of practices. Now this slide on page 68 basically shows what local stormwater engineers have to deal with. They need to provide groundwater recharge. They have to treat a certain amount of runoff for water quality purposes. They need to protect stream channels. And as you can see, the bubble gets bigger. You have to deal with big storms that go out of bank and extreme storms like they're having up in Massachusetts right now, those 100, 200-year storm events that create flooding and so forth. Now, the interesting thing is most wetlands are relatively insensitive to extreme storms and overbank storms. In fact, that's one of their great benefits in terms of flood storage. It's a temporary event. It drains down in most cases and doesn't have an impact. But the other three areas, recharge, water quality, in some cases channel protection, are very important to set specific stormwater criteria, particularly if the wetlands are deemed sensitive. So moving to slide 69, let's look at the recharge criteria. This simply is something in the ordinance or the manual that specifies that designers must infiltrate anywhere between a tenth to a half inch of runoff into the ground based on the soil type. And there's a number of ways it can be done. It's now used in Maryland and New Jersey, but it's a really important incentive or stick, depending on how you look at it, to get people to practice better site design and low-impact development. Everyone loves low-impact development and better site design, but it doesn't happen as much as it should. So these recharge criteria, I think, are an effective strategy for doing so. Water quality criteria, probably the most important. It's important on slide 70 that regular stormwater criteria be expanded. The first rule, in our view, is to provide full water quality treatment prior to discharge to a downgradient wetland. To be honest, we'd prefer if you didn't discharge to a downgradient wetland. But if you do, full water quality treatment, which in most regions of the country means you have to take the runoff from the 1 to 1.2-inch rainfall event and fully treat it. Now, if you have more sensitive wetlands, like bogs and fens, there are stormwater criteria that actually set no net increase in phosphorus load. Isn't this fascinating how wetland people and stormwater people can have no net in their lifestyles? The last criteria have been rarely applied, but they're growing fairly rapidly, and that is a criteria to maintain the hydro period of wetlands that regulate how much storm bounce you can have, what duration of inundation. It's shown on slide 71, and the discharge rate to and from the wetland. Now, the difference is it requires a great deal more modeling and often a great deal more upstream storage to maintain that. The key areas where this is being done are in the certain parts of Minnesota, King County, Washington, and elsewhere. And they do require the designer to do a lot more design, but it is a way to deal with the major hydrologic stress that we talked about earlier. And slide 72, I'm going to skip. Slide 73 gets to the second area. We can increase stormwater criteria, or we can specify specific or preferred stormwater practices. If we have development in the contributing drainage area, we would first look at infiltration. We'd second look at bioretention. Third, look at a bypass to a downstream pond so that we're not discharging to the wetland. And then an upstream stormwater wetland or an upstream stormwater pond. So those are the basic sequence of preference in terms of what we want to do. Moving on to slide 74, just getting back to a point I made earlier about stormwater wetlands. They're the real chia pets in the wetland world. And the first generation of stormwater wetlands is shown on slide 74. And they're just a monoculture of cattails or frag or whatever you might have in the neighborhood. And, you know, it's nothing to write home about. And it's, again, describes why those indirect impacts are so important to control. So the first generation, these facilities were built largely in the early 80s. We've gone to a second generation, which is shown in slide 75. It has better diversity, but still is that freshwater emergent model. And again, we're missing something at the edge of the wetland, which is we just have grass. And over time, what we've seen in design is having a range of water depths and microtopography and so forth can really create a fairly diverse system. But we still have a ways to go, which is shown in slide 76, which is what we're pushing now is if about two-thirds of our wetlands are forested wetlands, why don't we just skip the difference and go straight to designing a forested wetland where we have a range of depth zones, we have tree mounds, and we're trying to design a system that's much more similar to our natural reference conditions. And so we've put out a series of guidance manuals on watershed and stormwater forestry techniques that are available from the center. But I guess the key point is that maybe it's time to get away from the freshwater emergent model and try to go to a forested wetland, because most of our stormwater wetlands are not maintained. And if we go back to slide 75 for a minute, look at the difference there. You have a fine emergent wetland in most cases, but then you have a grass buffer leading to a forest. Why not have an entire forested wetland system? All right, moving to slide 77, and I'm hopefully winding up here, and I'm going to skip a couple of slides. No, I think I can do it. To protect wetlands, we need to deal with how wastewater and other non-stormwater discharge are handled. Again, it'll be different in every community, but if your wetlands are nutrient-sensitive, more frequent septic system inspections might be called for, and possibly even more enhanced nutrient removal technologies on on-site wastewater systems. Active enforcement of dumping restrictions and alternative mosquito control methods are all worth considering. And definitely look for illicit discharge surveys at the outfalls entering wetlands. And again, the WI, or Wetland Impact Assessment Method the centers develop helps figure out which of the non-stormwater discharge problems need to be addressed. In this case, the big issue is prevention of dumping, which, you know, why do people dump in wetlands? Well, think about it. Would you rather dump uphill or downhill? Being lazy, dumpers dump downhill, which is usually where the wetlands are located. The last tool is watershed stewardship, and I think the point has been made by several callers and commenters that education is very essential. I won't go through it right now, but I think this would be a great discussion point during the Q&A period. in the sense that we have a lot of different stewardship and education activities to conduct. And I'm going to skip slide 80. It's a fascinating slide, but it's over, and turn it over to Ron.
Thanks, Tom. As Tom indicated, we are on our last legs here, slide 81, our fourth and final question and answer break. We will take your questions in just a minute, but before we do that, let me first again draw your attention to where you can obtain Tom's contact information. If you're online, simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. From there, you'll be returned to the home page, which has Tom's email address and phone number. At the bottom of the home page, you will find two additional items. One is the link to additional resources, which I mentioned at the beginning of today's session. Clicking this link will direct you to several useful watershed and wetland resources from EPA and other organizations. And while I'm on that note, if you advance to slide 82, you'll see a couple other resources that are in Tom's slides. The second item at the bottom of your homepage is the seminar feedback form. Please consider completing this form as we do look at your comments while working to improve our webcasts. A few other notes. Our next webcast will be June 28th. Charlie McPherson of PetroTech and Chris Connor of EPA's Chesapeake Bay Program will give a presentation tentatively titled Influencing Behaviors Using Social Marketing. Charlie and Chris will describe how social marketing techniques can be applied in your watershed to influence behaviors and build environmental stewardship. Just a programming note to you folks. We usually hold our webcasts on the third Wednesday of the month, but this next webcast will be June 28th, the fourth Wednesday. Please mark your calendars accordingly. We do encourage folks to check out EPA's Watershed Discussion Forum at www.epa.gov/watershedforum. You can go to that website to discuss more issues related to this topic. We also encourage folks to return to www.epa.gov/watershedwebcasts for notices about upcoming webcasts as part of Watershed Academy. With all those notes out of the way, I will now resume our question and answer period. Tom, our first question comes from April in Vermont, who wants to know, what do you do in urban areas when there is literally no space for stormwater management areas except for the wetlands?
Great question, April. There are a lot of techniques in engineering to avoid the impact. I know that there's a lot of landlocked areas in Massachusetts, but the first approach is to treat as close to the source as possible to reduce the volume through bioretention, infiltration, and so forth. In some cases, underground treatment may be required for water quality purposes. So again, the idea is there may be a few exceptions, but good engineering can usually find some way to treat at least the quality of stormwater runoff prior to its discharge into a wetland.
Thanks, Tom. And now we have an email from Vina, who tells us that her favorite wetland is Shelby Bottoms along the Cumberland River in Nashville, Tennessee. Vina was interested in your comments on the wetland buffer ordinance and wants to know, you said that there was a better option rather than having a specific number such as the number of feet of buffer concerning wetlands. Could you elaborate on what that better option is?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big shift is that communities are looking to map their green infrastructure, wetlands, forests, streams, and so forth. And whereas they might use a fixed width as a guide, they would create a map, if you will, that shows how the stream buffers and wetlands and shorelines would be connected together and what the regulatory status of those areas are. Part of the reason for that gets into stream buffers, which in many parts of the country they're defined as the blue lines on a USGS map. It just so happens that about 40% of headwater streams are missed. And so because of that, communities are now, with the advent of GPS technology, going out and actually identifying the true perennial streams. So it's a much tighter way to to handle it rather than just using a tried and true but inflexible rule.
Thanks, Tom. We also have a question from Eaton, I'm sorry if I messed that name up, who's coming out of Nebraska, and this is in regard to an earlier comment you made, Tom, about artificial wetlands that didn't always work out the way that was originally planned. Does that mean that you were not in favor of artificial wetlands, or could you build upon that, so to speak?
Well, no, thank you for raising that point. I think the analogy I use is artificial wetlands are like our kids. When they were first born, you had a lot of expectations for them that, you know, they'd be, you know, healthy and clean and reverent and, you know, take out the trash. By the time they grow up, you're just happy if they move out of the house and get a job. And I think with stormwater wetlands and wastewater wetlands, they can perform a specific function, like pollutant removal, with good engineering. But what we didn't see is the natural diversity that we expected. So they became cattail-like systems. Now, I do feel that, you know, the next generation can be improved greatly, but it's those hydrologic stressors and the pollutant loads that will fundamentally mean that there'll be a somewhat diminished or degraded wetland type. And they'll be very prone to invasive species. But no, given a choice, I guess my favorite BMP is bioretention, but, you know, it might come back in the next life as a stormwater wetland. Who knows?
I knew Tom when he had a rat tail. I guess he would have come back as a cat tail. Tom, we have a question from Marietta out of Florida, and I guess this is really more targeted toward our EPA folks here at Watershed Academy Central. Marietta wants to know, does EPA offer any educational programs for local communities?
Yeah, EPA actually sponsors a wide range of national associations to provide technical assistance to local communities. As you probably are aware, EPA can't get out there themselves, so we rely on folks like the Center for Watershed Protection and Tom Schuler's staff, as well as organizations such as the Isaac Walton League of America, which is, again, a good resource to go to, the National Association of County Officials and ICMA, International City Managers Association, also have excellent wetland education programs and web-oriented outreach material on wetlands, in addition to the Center for Watershed Protection. Another good place to go is the Association of State Wetland Managers, who could give you more information about state-specific education programs for the local governments, and that's listed in your resource page. And I'm going to hand the phone over to our Web Academy folks just to have them reiterate the online resources that we have for local governments.
Thank you, Rebecca. Yes, of course, we have support a lot of associations to get out educational materials, but here at EPA, we have a number of websites that we provide educational materials, and one of them, the Watershed Academy, which sponsors this webcast, of course, does these monthly webcasts. In addition, we also have the online Watershed Academy training modules. We have approximately 50 training modules that are available on the Internet at no charge. They're free, available anywhere, anytime. And that's at epa.gov/watertrain. That's one word. So if anybody wants to do a module, there's one on wetlands functions and values. There's one that we've posted that the Center for Watershed Protection did on the 8 Tools for Watershed Protection that Tom mentioned, and there are many more. You also, if you're interested, you can just peruse the modules, or if you like, you can earn a certificate, and yours truly will sign it. All you have to do is do the 15 required modules and send an email to wacademy@epa.gov. That's a few of the resources, many other resources at epa.gov/OL. And that's spelled O-W-O-W.
Thanks. And for those of you who didn't recognize the voice, that was Ann Weinberg. We do have a couple minutes left. We will unmute the phone lines. And we know the drill by now. If you have a question, please announce your name and be acknowledged.
This is Phil North at Region 10 again. I have a question. If you have any suggestions about doing these practices in cold climates, and particularly in the spring when the snow is melting but the ground is still frozen?
Yeah, excellent question. Many of the practices, like stormwater wetlands, like bioretention, like infiltration, can work effectively in cold climates, but they have to be designed a little differently. It's outside of the scope of this call today, but if you send me an email, we recently put together with the state of Minnesota a manual on stormwater for cold climates up there, and there's some other work in Toronto and elsewhere. So basically the idea is you have to design things a little different to deal with ice and snow, and you have to make sure that you're accounting for snow storage in the winter months. But these practices can treat snowmelt pretty effectively.
Do we have any other questions from the phone lines?
Yes, this is Chris Conway with Kennedy Jenks in Reno, Nevada.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I'm. How do you address the concerns of agencies like our district health department has some very stringent requirements for constructed wetlands and ponds as far as the side slopes. They want steep slides, side slopes, and relatively deep water on the pond or wetland edges to discourage the growth of wetland vegetation and prevent the breeding of mosquitoes.
Yeah, I'm glad somebody finally brought up mosquitoes and by association, West Nile virus and other things ill and whatnot. Mosquitoes have changed, again, how people design, but it's still possible to design a good stormwater wetland, a good stormwater pond, and a good bioretention area that doesn't generate mosquitoes. It's just a new way of looking at it, and there are several good guidance manuals available on how to do the designs. But I think the bigger question the gentleman was asking is many communities have pretty bad stormwater manuals or drainage requirements that are built on avoiding problems, avoiding maintenance, and so on and so forth. And so to change things locally requires a pretty extensive education program by a full range of stormwater engineers and planners and others that are involved in the development game, and to look to other communities around the country that have experimented with innovative approaches and found them very effective.
Thanks, Tom. At this time, I'd like to conclude today's webcast. I'd like to especially thank Tom Schuler for presenting today, and thanks to everyone who joined us and submitted your excellent questions. Again, please do submit your evaluation for this webcast, and we look forward to having you participate in our next webcast, June 28th, Influencing Behaviors Using Social Marketing. That ends our webcast for today. Thank you.